Happy Sabbath, everybody. Had some advice from my last message. I was told, speak up a little louder. Don't crinkle the water bottle. And there's a couple of other things I forget. So we'll work on no crinkling and finishing on time. I'm assuming Dr. Holliday is still speaking today, right? Second message. You know, the great thing about speaking first is if you don't really like my message, you can just go to sleep and you're refreshed and rested for Dr. Holliday's second message when it starts. I won't even be offended. Today, I want to talk a little bit about Nehemiah. I guess I gave two messages on Jeremiah this year, and today's will be on Nehemiah. I've had the chance to go to Israel a couple times with multiple trips back to Jerusalem. You know, you drive all over the country, but something about getting back to Jerusalem keeps luring you back to that city. It's where it's not the prettiest part of Israel, but it's where the energy is at, so to speak. It's where the most history is at. It's where, you know, you had roughly two dozen civilizations that were built on top of one another. There's a lot of energy in that city. So today I want to use a section of Nehemiah's life. Basically, we're going to talk about a short period of just a few months, because you could make a 10-part series on Nehemiah. I'm going to try just keep it simple and not go overboard with slides and information. But Nehemiah is important to me because God wants to use dedicated, trustworthy people of courage and faith to get his work done, right? And that's what Nehemiah did. And so we're going to talk about this great servant and his leadership of Judah in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and reestablishing God's laws. At the time of Nehemiah, as you probably well know, both kingdoms had fallen. The northern kingdom of Israel had fallen in 720 to 700 BC during the reign of Hezekiah. And Judah was saved. Pretty much Jerusalem only. All the other Jewish cities most of them were hauled away, including Lachish. Over 100 years later, 586 BC, Babylon comes down, takes over Judah and Jerusalem, and they haul them back into captivity by the Tigris and Euphrates River. So at this time, Nehemiah is around 445 BC. He's serving the king Artaxerxes, and a portion of the Jews had already returned to Jerusalem from exile to rebuild the temple under Ezra, and Nehemiah is to catch up later. So, according to Watch Jerusalem, Nehemiah is known as one of the holy city's greatest rebuilders. I would also add in there Hezekiah, Solomon, King Herod, and just to name a few. Yet for millennia, evidence of Nehemiah's existence has remained buried beneath multiple layers of civilizations in Jerusalem. Everyone's always wanting to doubt that each biblical character existed, right? With archaeology, there continues to be new developments. United, if you look up some of United information on this, there's some articles written back 2004. 2004, they had yet to find some of Nehemiah's walls by the city of David. So that happened in 2007, just 3 years later. So every year they're finding new things, which is really exciting. While he himself hasn't turned up in archaeology, a lot of his contemporaries and the characters mentioned in his life have popped up in archaeology, whether on papyrus or a coin or pottery or what I call these Syrian footballs. They're like cuneiform. There was a Jewish settlement in Egypt on the Nile River on the island of Elephantine, however you say it. It was a Jewish settlement. And in 1907, they found a roll of papyrus paper explaining exactly how the Passover was kept in, you know, 445 BC during the time of Nehemiah. So there's, and they mentioned Sanballat and other of his enemies in that letter. So there is proof of the stories. So Nehemiah, who is he? Okay. He was a Jewish captive in Babylon around the time of 445 BC again. And the Bible describes him as a royal servant to King Artaxerxes. Now, Nehemiah was an important person in the kingdom of Babylon. Again, like Joseph, Moses, Daniel, and Esther before him, Nehemiah appears to have been placed by God in a strategic position in a high level in a foreign imperial government to accomplish God's will on the world scene. And he refers to himself at the end of chapter 1 as the king's cupbearer. Now, that might not be an honor position at my house if I'm gonna bring you your wine or your beverage. I'm serving you. But in this ancient tradition, this was an honor position of trust. Consider that a cupbearer was to ensure against the poisoning of a ruler. So there was much more to the job than that. The apocryphal book of Tobit, also from the Persian period, refers to certain Ahikar as a chief cupbearer, keeper of the signet, and in charge of the administration of the accounts under King Sennacherib of Assyria, the previous king who hauled away the northern kingdom of Israel. Gave a message on Hezekiah's tunnel, which was quite a lot of fun. It was more fun going through the tunnel, actually. But if you look at the Expositor Bible's commentary, they note, varied sources suggest something about Nehemiah as a royal cupbearer. He would have been well-trained in court etiquette. According to Daniel 1:4, and Josephus, he says he would have been probably a handsome individual because they typically picked young men without any physical defect, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He would have been able to teach the language and the literature of the Babylonians. He would certainly have known how to select the wines set before the king. That's not one of my skill sets. My wife is a lot better at it. If we are out at a restaurant and I want to have a glass of wine, I'll just tell them anything from Spain or Italy or France, something dry. I can't drink the California wines. You know, they just put so much sugar in them, it doesn't sit well with me. So anyway, he would have chosen the wines for each meal. There's a proverb in the Babylonian Talmud that states, the wine belongs to the master, but credit for it is due to his cupbearer. He would have been a trusted companion, willing to lend an ear at all times. He would have great influence as one with the closest access to the king, able to determine at times who was able to see the master. And above all, Nehemiah had to be one who enjoyed the unreserved confidence of the king. There was a great need for trustworthy court attendants, and that's underscored by the fact that his father was, you know, killed in his sleep by one of his servants. So servants had close access to them. Now, on top of that, in order to be a successful cupbearer, you know, meaning not a dead one, I imagine some of them would have died drinking the wine and testing it for the king before they gave it to him, right? If they didn't know what was going on in their administration, if they didn't know what was going on in the government and in the kitchen and the supply chain, they would probably be the first one they would end up dead. So they had a vested interest in protecting the king as well. But he would have to be very discerning to know who was an ambitious enemy looking to supplant the king, who was foe, who was a friend. I asked myself, why would Artaxerxes put a foreigner, or you might say a foreigner if you're from the south, why would you put a foreigner in charge of that role? Why would you put a man whose people you conquered and brutally murdered and then dragged into captivity into the role of protecting you? I mean, I dare say if Judah Maccabee was in that position, he would have poisoned, the Maccabees definitely would have poisoned Artaxerxes as they revolted against Rome later on. But he didn't. So, it means he had godly character, and he was letting his light shine. And he was an example to all around him, as we should be, including the king himself. Imagine if, Trump's out of office now, but imagine if Joe Biden called you up tomorrow and wanted you to serve in his administration. I don't know, pick a role, any particular role. I would imagine there'd be some of his policies you might not agree with, like, you know, men competing in women's track, for example. That made the headlines this week, transgenderism. But you wouldn't be at liberty to just tell Mr. Biden, you know, your opinion. And even the president today can't just kill you if he doesn't like you. But in ancient times, that's what happened. You just got your head lopped off. I mean, Artaxerxes actually killed his brother just before that. So he would not hesitate to kill a cupbearer. Anyway, a lot of God's servants have had a tough time serving. Imagine Moses, Joseph, Daniel, and others have always had to serve kings that had ultimate power. There was no balance of power like we have today with three branches of government. And they had to serve no matter if they agreed or disagreed with their policy, example, while they're doing it. And they had to learn to stay in their lane. So remember that even though, my point is that even though Nehemiah had a high and trusted position, he was not at liberty to speak to Artaxerxes whenever and however he wanted to, just as Esther wasn't allowed to speak to his father as well. She prayed and fasted for 3 days before she went and spoke to Xerxes, right? Because the consequences, if he didn't like it, was death. And this will make more sense in just a minute. Let's look at Artaxerxes for a second. Artaxerxes I, again, he's heavily attested to in archaeology. He was a real person. You can go to the next slide. I have the controller?
Yeah,
it's fine. You shouldn't give me the controller. I don't know how to use these things. I'll just describe it instead. Artaxerxes, he's all over archaeology. His reign was generally peaceful. He's described by the ancient Greeks as magnanimous and kind, even to his enemies at times. And this is exactly the kind of man that's portrayed in the book of Nehemiah. Remember, he's one of the most powerful men in the ancient world. Artaxerxes was even kind enough to provide him like an armed escort and letters so that he wouldn't be stopped along the way and interrogated. Here we go. So, I love Google Maps. I'm always curious how long it takes to get from point A to point B. And one thing that's sort of increased my faith over the years is just visiting some of these biblical sites. I realize faith is believing without seeing, right? I understand that. But there's something about going to places like modern-day Turkey or Israel or Jordan to see some of these archaeological sites and take the pictures home with you and review them. I'm not going to inundate you with photos today, at my wife's request, but there's plenty of information to look up if you're curious. The trip would have taken him, on the right you can see Babylon. He would have had to go up to avoid, it's all desert below, so he would have to go on to the north and then come back down by the way of the sea. That's a common trade route. It's roughly 1,000 miles. So I'm assuming he was on horseback. He had an animal. Doesn't say if it's a mule or a donkey or a horse. But I'm assuming it was a horse. It would have taken him probably 2 months, roughly, with the Sabbaths. So it's ironic that he spent more time in his journey, roughly 60 days, I would imagine, than it even took to build the wall, because it took 52 days for him to build the wall itself. So, next slide. So, a couple months later, Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem. At this point, it's still a city in ruins. Thankfully, he gets permission to procure building materials from the king's forest, because this is no longer owned by, you know, it's not Solomon's land anymore. It's owned by Babylon. So he's able to get materials from the king's forest to build all the gates, and he was given a bit of a military escort. This picture in particular is actually King Hezekiah's wall. that was, so it's 2,700 years old, but it's the section they call the Broad Wall. So Nehemiah, he repaired the existing walls, and there were a number of walls that were built through the ages. This one was kind of discovered almost by accident after the Six-Day War, when Israel went to war with practically every country surrounding them that were bombing the city. The houses were uninhabitable when it was done, so they brought in, you know, archaeologists and said, let's take advantage of this opportunity to dig. And as they dug, they dug down and they were able to find Hezekiah's wall. So there was another monumental discovery that's 2,700 years old. It's mind-boggling. So Nehemiah's wall, he didn't just build a brand new wall all the way around the city. He definitely repaired a lot of the broken down walls and then built a few new sections. So when he arrived safely in Judah, he took a few chosen men and his horse, and he stole away at night to survey the state of the walls around Jerusalem. Now this is quite the rugged. Jerusalem's on a ridge, basically, in ancient times. Now it's been filled in a lot, but at the time it was basically a ridge with valleys all around. It was in such a state of disrepair and debris everywhere that at one point he just had to get off and walk because the horse couldn't even travel through the rubble. So after viewing the destruction, they had a huddle up. Like, he's the quarterback, he's bringing his guys in. Let's build a game plan, okay? He gathered the rulers, the priests, and the laymen, and informed them of his plans to rebuild the city. Now, they'd been there for quite some time at that point, and I think they were probably too discouraged. They needed someone to come in and be the quarterback to run this operation and give them some motivation. Remember, at this point, the second temple had already been built just a few years prior, and they were already trying to revive the Sabbath and the holidays and such. But by Nehemiah's time, Jerusalem still lay completely open to attack. And without the city wall and the gates, which had been burned by fire, they just weren't able to live in peace and harmony, and they couldn't live inside the city. So Nehemiah intended to change that by exerting a massive rebuilding effort. However, the enemies all around were getting to resume their verbal and physical attacks. And I want you to imagine for a second building a wall that's probably a couple miles long and in distance, probably 30 to 40 feet high, 10 to 20 feet wide in sections. If I were just to say today to the congregation, you know, hey, I got a contract to build a section, 2.5 miles of wall down along the Mexico border. Joe Biden has hired me to go build this wall. And I'm looking for volunteers. I need like 50,000 people, right? We're not going to use skid steers or backhoes or bulldozers. And we're going to be attacked by human traffickers and drug dealers along the way. And it's going to be hot and dusty. I mean, how many volunteers would I get? Especially when the pay is really low. We're not going to get a lot of volunteers. This was people of all ages, probably male and female, working hot, hard, dusty work. And it says they worked from sun up until the stars came out. So that's, you know, until the stars came out, that's an hour after sunset. You might be looking at 12-hour days or more. So in my business, I've built probably hundreds of walls over the years. And I can tell you, it taxes even the strongest, youngest guys that are in their 20s. After, let's say, a two-week project of lugging 100-pound concrete blocks, or we do boulder walls that weigh up to 5,000 pounds, get them off of 18-wheelers, we have machinery. You still have to move stuff by hand. We use all different size boulders. So we built walls that are similar to these walls. And I'm telling you, it's brutal work. And to work 52 days straight, besides a Sabbath, you know, by hand, is just it's a monumental feat, and it's just a miracle of God. There's no other explanation for it, especially the fact that he's doing this not with slaves and not with all stonemasons. I'm sure there were some stonemasons in the group, but you weren't working with 100% stonemasons. These were everyday people, jewelers and bankers and bakers, farmers, ranchers, right, shepherds. So the rulers of the surrounding lands, they really relished in the fact that Jerusalem and Judah lay in utter ruin. And they mocked Nehemiah for even thinking he could rebuild Jerusalem. I really like this part of the story. In Nehemiah's time particularly, the opposition picked up. It was a little more fierce because they were starting to win, right? They had a plan. They were going to do something. They weren't going to be beat down. So the chiefs of the land, namely Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah, we're going to focus on Sanballat, they rose up initially just in ridicule when they started, later on for more bloodthirsty reasons. In Nehemiah 2, verse 19, it says, they laughed at us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing you're going to do? Are you going to rebel against the king? And Nehemiah answered him and said, the God of heaven, he will prosper us, and therefore we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion and no right, no memorial, and no part in Jerusalem. He says, the God will prosper us, and you have no part. That's quite a rebuke and quite a lot of power in one sentence. And if you notice Nehemiah's response and his leadership, I mean, they were making fun of it, saying that just a fox climbing upon it would knock it down. They had all kinds of jeers, kind of like, I'm sure, what happened with Sennacherib and Hezekiah, you know, a few 275 years before that. Notice that Nehemiah didn't let his ego get involved or get pricked. He answered a fool according to his folly. He put him in his place, but he gave God all the credit. And while at the same time, reinforcing Judah's legitimate claim to the city on a hill. He said that we have historical rights to the city. You don't. And he'd been given permission. He not only had authority by God, he had authority by the most powerful man on earth at that time, which was Artaxerxes. So, next slide. The task of rapidly building Jerusalem's wall in 52 days officially began. Nehemiah 3 gives a detailed account of the various sections of the wall assigned to various workmen. So he divided the men up into groups to tackle each section, right? And they would have been working, you know, in very close proximity. The chapter begins by describing the northernmost part of the wall surrounding the temple and traces the description of the wall counterclockwise around the city and back up to the north position. And this has all been verified by archaeology again. And in the beginning, the enemies weren't terribly upset because they didn't think that Judah would be successful because it was such a monumental task. As the wall got further and further along, they started to get a bit more concerned, a bit more worried. Again, this is actually Hezekiah's wall that Nehemiah would have repaired. There are some sections that he built up with the towers, and I don't have them on me today, so I won't show you those. But about halfway through, Nehemiah's opponent, Sanballat, which I like to compare with Satan, Sanballat probably was working with Satan, was infuriated by the progress on the city wall, especially once the height was, you know, halfway finished. And he goes through this process of sending letters to Nehemiah, you know, saying, hey, man, let's come on out to this open area. Let's talk, you know. I don't necessarily think you should be building this wall. Let's just talk about it. And Nehemiah would respond to him and say, I'm busy building the wall. I don't have time to come to you. Why should I stop this? And this process went, you know, it went on four times. He was sending him sealed letters. And the fifth letter was an unsealed document, where he really put forth some accusations saying, you know, what you're really trying to do is rebel against Artaxerxes and set yourself up as a king. And that's when Nehemiah ultimately rebuked him. But if you consider Sanballat's approach towards Nehemiah, he was trying to draw him out of the safety and security of the walls of the city. And that's always Satan's approach as well. He wants to get us out of the church. You know, I feel like God has still put a hedge around us, like he put the hedge around Job. And he showed Job, once you remove the hedge, Job got to see what happens when the hedge is removed. Satan can really move in and attack. And Nehemiah refused to leave the safety of the walls. We as Christians should be remembering that when we're staying in the sheepfold, when we're staying in the Word, we're staying on our knees, and we're fellowshipping with others, and we get all this renewal from coming to church, from being together, from spending time and building character, all these things. When we leave, when we take a break or we stray from God, we're giving Satan that opportunity to get us out in the open and to find us wherever we're vulnerable, wherever we're weak. And we need to just remember that Satan really is like the old Wile E. Coyote, you know? I've got this coyote in my backyard that keeps coming for my chickens. And I'm trying to catch him in one of those big cages, you know, and put him across the river. But he's got a lot of tricks. And Satan's very wily. He's got all kinds of tricks up his sleeves. And every one of us has different strengths and weaknesses. So Satan doesn't attack us. He doesn't attack us all in the same way, right? He knows where I'm strong, you're weak, where you're weak, I'm strong. We all have different blind spots. And he's smarter than all of us, so he knows how to get to them. So, again, together with the Arabians, Ammonites, and Ashdodites, secret plans were made to launch a surprise attack against Jerusalem. This is about when it was about halfway built. So they had to start building the wall with a tool in one hand. The people that carried the materials were carrying literally a sword in one hand and maybe a basket of dirt. You know, you had to backfill these walls, or the rocks in another. And then the actual guildsmen, the masons, were working with a sword at their side. So, under Nehemiah's direction, a defensive force was mobilized to guard the builders. And shifts were taken, and watchmen kept a sharp lookout, and a system of alarm was devised. They still had the shofars and the trumpet, and they were quite spread out, right? And the people were few by comparison. The threat of imminent war became so severe that the workmen literally had to carry a weapon in one hand and a construction tool in the other. So the foreign armies, I think once they realized their plans for attack were known, seemed less eager for war. But Nehemiah maintained strict military readiness nonetheless. Opposition that he was facing was not only felt from outside sources. He had an issue he was dealing with his own brethren. Again, some of the noblemen, it says, would not put their shoulder to work. Some of the rich, they didn't want to physically participate in the work. They were living richly while the others were suffering. And once Nehemiah learned what was going on, he strongly rebuked the nobles and shook it up and demanded that all their debts be lifted immediately. They were being overtaxed, charged interest, and it was wrong. So the nobles complied with these commands. Let me go to the next slide. This is a slide of what Jerusalem would have looked like during the time of Nehemiah. You got the second temple up on top, the city of David down below, the Kidron Valley on the right, Hinnom Valley to the south, and then to the west on the left side. That really would not have been heavily occupied at the time. Later on, for the third temple, it definitely would have been, 445 years later. It was heavily occupied. And now, today, the city walls are, they're probably three times that size, I'd say, easily. But still, difficult conditions. So, seeing Nehemiah's wall near completion, Sanballat, again, he continued to attempt to draw Nehemiah into various situations to at least discredit his authority and perhaps even... Is it funny? Is that Josiah? Who is that? Yeah. Discredit him and maybe even kill him. So luckily Nehemiah, he didn't fall for any of the temptations. There was another one where he was told that, a plot was there to take his life, and he should run and hide into the temple. And he refused, stayed out in the open. He was attacked verbally by quite a few. And eventually the wall was complete within 52 days. They hung the gates. The whole thing was complete. They shut the city up, closed it up. It was ready to go. And it was a remarkable feat, again, considering the fact that everyday people of all ages, probably both sexes, there was only two genders in biblical times. I know now we have 12 or 15, but there was only two. And again, I've built a lot of walls over the years. Some I've done myself. Mostly I subcontract, or I used to have employees that would do a lot of them. And it's absolutely backbreaking work, even with heavy equipment. So, and I could tell you the city of David is a very steep hill, actually. So getting materials up and down that ridge would have been quite difficult. And if you're 30 or 40 feet up on this east side, you're still looking at more like a 60, 70 foot fall. They would have had their scaffolding out, and it would have just been an amazing feat, even if 50,000 people were working on it. And it's encouraging that in the end, God got the credit for it, not just from Judah, but the surrounding nations and the surrounding people. You can read Nehemiah 6, verse 16. It reads, "And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen, the pagans, people of, not worshiping the one true God, it came to pass when they all heard about and saw these things that they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God." So God gets the credit. I mean, how great would that be today if there was a miracle that was performed by the church? It was so amazing that the whole world declares, wow, that their God is real. You know, he gets the credit for this act. So nearly 1 week after the completion of the wall, on the next holiday, the Jews gather before the water gate to hear Ezra the scribe read to them from the book of the law, the Torah. Because some of the... there had to be revival, right? And Zerubbabel and Ezra took it so far. I think Nehemiah built upon that foundation and took it even further. He helped in some of the administrative duties, and he helped get them back on track with Feast of Tabernacles and other issues they had. So they had lost some of the knowledge. Ezra, who had specifically prepared himself for the job of teaching it, opened the book, and the entire congregation, out of deep respect and humility, immediately stood up, Nehemiah 8:5, with tears of repentance mixed with great joy, and the people began to relearn and rededicate themselves to the instruction given through the prophet Moses 1,000 years before. And you know, at the end, they, when the wall was finished, they split the choir into two groups, and they all got up on the wall. The wall was wide enough that, you know, dozens of people could stand up there together at the same time. And one choir went one direction, the other went the other way, and they all met at the top and just celebrated the whole process. It would have been a monumental feat. And there's a lot more lessons you could go through with Nehemiah, but I need to wrap this up. So, for the sake of time, let's focus on the lessons from his early life, one of great faith and works. Nehemiah was a powerful leader who would not be led along by the masses. He wasn't gonna follow others, and he wasn't gonna take the easy route. Again, remember that he gave up a pretty privileged position. He had access to all the best food, the best wine, the best clothing, and all the culture and dancing and music. He had all that in Babylon, in the king's court, just like Moses did. Moses had access to all that with Pharaoh, and Moses left. He sacrificed his life for the people. Nehemiah left for 12 years to go to a city that was in ruins. That's a great sacrifice. But his life's work was one of going against the flow, going against the grain. no matter the persecution, be it from surrounding armies or even his own people. He stood up for God to do what's right without deviation. And his story, as recorded in the Bible, stands as a testament to the work God was able to do through him. And he serves as a example for us to model our lives after. So I've got just five little points here. Nehemiah's example. Number one, in his early life, he obviously had godly character and wisdom. He must have had a good foundation as a young man, as a teenager, an honest man, because he had a very trusted, he was chosen for a very trusted position in Artaxerxes' court, and he maintained that position. So he spent his whole life preparing to be in that trusted position, even if he didn't know that. We're always, that's the point, he probably didn't know he was going to be the cupbearer when he was 5 years old or 10 years old. And we don't all know what role we're going to be assigned in the kingdom. But we are preparing right now for that role. We don't know what it'll be exactly, but we do know we will be helping others and leading by example. And we need to be growing in this godly character right now. This is our time to learn. Number two, he relied on God as a source of his strength, whereas a lot of other people might rely on the government, you know, or their family, or their heritage, or their money, you know. A lot of people rely on their money. I'm not saying money's a bad thing. I heard, you know, Mr. McCurdy's sermon last week or 2 weeks ago. I agreed with it. But he relied on God as a source of his strength. Upon the news from Hanani that the Jerusalem walls lay in ruins, the first thing he did, his reaction was to fall to his knees and pray and mourn for days in prayer and fasting. So God was his source of strength. Number three, sacrifice. Again, I already covered this point. He gave up so much to go and work really hard for 12 years in Jerusalem. He gave up such a life of luxury to work with the people of Judah, his countrymen. Number four, works. He had works and deeds, and he had work ethic. And Nehemiah took initiative and led by example, and I think he did some of this physical work of stacking one stone on top of another himself. It mentions that the noblemen wouldn't put their shoulder to it. Number five, he led a revival and led the people back to God. He really got them charged up and amped up and motivated to do this work in the face of all this danger of these other nations and these other peoples that didn't want the work done. And in conclusion, let me back up. He led the people to rebuild the wall, to reinstate the holy days, to repent and celebrate, and to cleanse the land of sin. He did this with conviction, and he did not mince words. And he cut people to the heart to make them turn back to God. And for that, he does get some credit. Obviously, most of the credit goes to God, but he has to have some credit for putting in the work. In conclusion, Nehemiah's example brings to light a scripture, one of my favorite, James 2, verse 10. James 2, verse 10. You all know the scripture, but this is the scripture, this is the personification of James 2, 10. Nehemiah could have said, "You have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." So let us all strive to live a life of faith and works like Nehemiah.